You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
We are constantly surrounded by the message that mom life is the tired life, the no time for myself life, the hard life. And while it can be hard and full of lots of showing up for others, the idea that being a mom means living a joyless life, a stale or shit show kind of life all the time, is something I am passionate about putting a stop to. My name is Ali Casaza, and I'm about to make your life so much lighter. You are listening to The Purpose Show. A quick note, because it is so important to me that I am able to authentically be myself and speak the way that I normally speak here on my podcast, not sugarcoat or be vanilla or wear a different mask when I'm talking to you guys here. You'll find the occasional curse word on my show. So if that bothers you, if it's not something you want your kids to hear, grab your headphones, girl. The Purpose Show podcast is part of the Airwave Media Podcast Network. Visit airwavemedia.com to listen and subscribe to other awesome shows like this one. Friends, I am so excited to officially announce to you that the Declutter Like a Mother planner is here and ready to be pre-ordered. I am literally so freaking excited about this. This is the official Declutter Like a Mother planner. I have always wanted to make a planner because I am a planner girl myself, and I have never really found like the perfect planner. So I created it. Basically, this is an undated planner because I hate when there's like month and year already assigned to it. Like, you don't know when I'm going to start using my planner. Get off my back. This is undated, so you can start and use it whenever you want. There's weekly and monthly and daily planning within the planner. So it's everything that you need. Also, there is space for gratitude or affirmations. There's space for you to write notes to yourself, space for you to keep this a very positive, high vibe space for yourself. And there is exclusive content from me that's designed to help you be actively decluttering your space and your life, and keeping yourself on track with living a simplified, abundant life and doing everything we talk about here on the podcast and in my books and in my corner of the internet. So this is the official planner from me. Go get it. You can get it anywhere books are sold: Target, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, your favorite indie bookstore, or online indie store, literally anywhere. Go get it. I am so excited. The Declutter Like a Mother planner. Make sure you tag me, and I want to see that you got it. So let's celebrate together. I love you guys. Thank you for supporting me. Laura, thank you so much for coming here and being with us on The Purpose Show. I'm so excited to speak with you.
Same, Allie. Thank you so much for having me. This is exciting for me. I love your show.
Thank you. I feel really connected with you from your book. I feel like you're such a good writer and you're such a vulnerable speaker. And the way that you, I mean, this, your book is an addiction memoir. But I benefited so much from it. And I'm not an addict, but I felt there's other things in my life that have had a hold on me. There's other things in my life that I related to in your book. And so I feel like this, I know who you wrote this book for, but I feel like it's for everyone. And I think that really takes a lot of skill to accomplish in a book like this.
Thank you. Thank you so much for saying that. It is an addiction memoir. That's the category you'll find it in. There are a few other categories that you'll find it in as well, but that's how it's being marketed. But I like to think that it is a book about my journey from my authentic self, where I departed from who I am authentically, which started when I was really young, and then my journey back toward my authentic self. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is really relatable for anyone. And it's also a book for anyone that's ever, you know, felt like they just didn't have the room to be themselves. Like they were in a spot, maybe they felt othered, maybe they felt shy or embarrassed or ashamed, and altered who they were to fit into whatever that scenario was. And, you know, I write, as you said, very vulnerably about where I was, because that's where it led me. Mm-hmm. Like, I didn't start out that way. I didn't start out in addiction. I don't know very many child addicts, but I'm sure they're out there. And I certainly didn't want that to be my path. But I believe that my departure from my authentic self was the scaffolding for the addiction. So I write about the worst part, the worst year of my life, to make that point.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that? Can we start there and talk about that year?
The worst year of my life?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. It was the year 2008. It's actually, I write about a 10-month period during that year. And, during that time, the book kind of starts where I've decided to end my marriage, which was, you know, maybe the scariest thing I'd ever done voluntarily up until that point in my life. And I had two sons. I have two sons. They're beautiful young men now in their 20s, but then they were little. And, you know, we were a family that people kind of put on a pedestal. We lived, we enjoyed a very privileged life, a high profile Hollywood life. And people respected us and admired us. And that felt really good. I loved being respected and admired that way and kind of put on that pedestal. I held a leadership position in my children's school community. I was the PTA president. I had just been asked to join the board. And I had this monster of an addiction that, you know, I really truly thought, I thought two things. I thought, one, I needed what I was taking, which was Ambien, in order to show up for my family. And that goes back to that departure from who I was authentically. It allowed me to show up the way I wanted to. And two, as bad as it got, and, you know, it kind of starts off with a medical emergency I have. I really thought that I could get a handle on it because I had done so with everything else in my life up until that point. And I just thought it was a matter of time and a matter of me kind of figuring it out. And what you see in the book is how hard I try. I really try to stay in my children's lives, to get divorced gracefully, and to not give up my drug of choice.
Can you speak to what role the burden of motherhood and like needing help to cope had in this addiction issue for you?
Yeah, that pedestal that I talked about being on as a family, we were on that pedestal also as a couple. Mm. And I, like I said, I enjoyed that spotlight. I enjoyed that status in my life. And I had a long track record of being a very prideful, self-sufficient. I did not like to ask for help. I certainly didn't want the people around me to know that I needed help. And so it was very isolating in a way, even though I was surrounded by people and there was always connection and I was doing dinner parties and tennis and jewelry shows and blah, blah, blah. I was very isolated into who I could source for help of any kind with anything. And I wanted to have one kid. I wanted to have two kids, but I didn't plan to have them back to back. One was born in 98. The other was born in 99. Both boys.
I have four total, but two of my boys are the same thing. 1 year of them, the next year.
Yeah. Four boys. Wow. And, you know, I just was really unprepared. I had kind of looked around at my friends who were having kids and it looked so easy. And I thought, oh, I'm going to roll right through this. I'm going to master this. Like, I'm going to be like, they're here. I'm going to be 10 levels up from them. I'm going to like be the best mom, the best whatever. And I really thought it would come easy and naturally for me. And that's not to say that I didn't have a very strong maternal instinct, because I did. I wasn't sure I would, because I never really liked kids.
Mm-hmm.
But when my first one was born, it just like it flooded in and I've never been the same.
Mm-hmm.
Same for my second one. But I didn't really know how to mom. Like, I was learning, it was on the job training for me. And I felt like, you know, not for the first time in my life, but the first time in my life where I had so many eyes on me, like I was failing. And before, my failures had been very quiet and private. And this felt like I was failing in public. And I was deeply ashamed of that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my kids were not good sleepers. And like, they just didn't sleep very long at night. And they woke each other up. And they were bedwetters. and they wanted to sleep with me or with us. And you know, my husband at the time had a job that took him away a lot. So a lot of the times it was just me. And so it was, I was just bedraggled. Like I was like a walking zombie who looked great, who still showed up for her workouts and her tennis lessons. But inside I was just like crumbling. And I didn't want, honestly, it wasn't like I didn't have anybody to ask. I didn't want to ask anybody. And I, again, just like the addiction, I thought I would figure it out. I thought I could read or watch, or, you know, there would be there was a learning curve. And then once I was past it, I would be better at it. But the lack of sleep was really, really getting to me. And so when my doctor prescribed Ambien for me, which, by the way, you know, I was addicted to Ambien. It's the whole book is about Ambien, but there's no shade on Ambien. I think it's a great drug when it's used as prescribed for the amount of time that it's supposed to be prescribed for, which is 10 to 15 days. I took it for years and you know, I built a tolerance to it. But when the doctor first prescribed Ambien for me, it felt like the answer. Like, I woke up with energy. I wanted to take my kids to the pumpkin patch. I didn't care, you know, if we didn't get out of, you know, the house on time because so-and-so spilled jam on their pants just as we were leaving. Like, I cared, but it didn't set me off because my nerves weren't so frayed. And I got to be the kind of mom I wanted when I was taking a pill every night.
And I would imagine that it's like the excitement of, oh my gosh, this is it. I get to be the mom I want to be, or like even the mom you wanted to be before you actually had the kids.
Yeah.
And then when did it turn? When did you kind of get like, oh shit, this is a problem?
I don't think I really felt like that until the chapter that I write about, which is rock bottom, which is, you know, it precedes me checking into treatment, but, you know, I call them the three horsemen: rationalizing, minimizing, and justifying. Like every time I would have the thought, like, maybe this is something I should look at, immediately, like I call it my addict mind, would go in and rationalize, but it was only one, or it was only that one night, and minimize it. You know, just like, oh, they, you know, you only overslept that one time. It's totally fine. And then justified it. You need these. You need these to show up. No one can fault you for that. Look at everything you do. So, you know, those thoughts were immediately dismissed by those three things every time. It was like, you know, it was the best prosecuting attorney or defense attorney was my addict mind. You know, every time anything came up, it could refute it in 10 different ways. And, you know, like I said, I had many things which probably should have been a bottom for me, where I should have taken a really hard look at what I was doing, not only to myself, but to my family. And I didn't. So the thing that actually got me to look at myself was kind of a non-event. You know, I just was at a point where I couldn't take my kids to see the fireworks on the 4th of July the way I planned, because I was in a really debilitating withdrawal, and I sent them with the neighbors. And you know, after they left, I couldn't get loaded and I couldn't be sober. And I knew that that was unsustainable, that I needed to do something because I wasn't going to be able to live in that place.
Can I ask you, looking back on this and what ended up happening, what do you think the solution was for you at the time that you took the Ambien and it got like this? Like, what would someone do instead? Because when I'm reading your book and I'm looking at everything and I watch your Instagram videos, I just am like, yeah, that makes so much sense. Like, what the hell else? Because I've been there. Like, I had 3 under 3 at one point, and it's exhausting. And I didn't have anything like that or do anything like that. But I was screaming at toddlers, babies, and I was absolutely unhinged and absolutely depressed and angry and a bitter version of myself. I was not the woman or mom I wanted to be. So Yeah, I've just been dying to ask you that question.
Well, thank you for sharing that with me. And, you know, you bring up a really good point, which was that I don't think I was depressed. I think what I was dealing with was postpartum anxiety. So like, even if my kids did sleep, the anticipation of them waking up would not allow me to sleep. And, you know, I describe it like I had an alarm bell ringing in my head until I took that first pill and it was silenced. But I think when I mentioned it to my OBGYN, who I really, really like, had he said, let's take a really close look at this and get you diagnosed and get that treated, I might not have gone down that path.
Okay.
Had I come back to him and insisted that this is something that should be looked at, I might have gone a different path. I did not, and he didn't. You know, he missed it, and I didn't insist. I didn't stand up for myself. And then that goes back to me being that prideful, self-sufficient. Had I confided in my close mom friends and said, hey, this is what I think I'm dealing with, or I don't know what I'm dealing with, but this is what my day looks like, they might have walked me back into my OBGYN's office and said, hey, she's struggling. You need to look at this. Mm-hmm. You know, those are the type of friends I have. My friends from then, my Sex and the City friends, I call them, they're still my circle of friends. And so we've been, you know, in each other's lives since our 20s. And, you know, they would have absolutely 100% figured out how to get me the help that I needed. Then that intervention could have prevented me going down the road that I did.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. So it was kind of like, oh, the sleeping is the issue. So you just need to sleep.
I treated the symptom, but not the problem.
I never would have seen it that way. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Damn, motherhood is a bitch sometimes.
Right?
Like, that's the moral of the story.
Yes. Come and go as they want.
Yeah.
Moms are filled with like raging hormones and sitting on ice rings and, you know, bare, like raw breastfeeding nipples.
If right? You breastfeed. All the things that
bleary eyed.
Yeah. I would love to. I've watched some of your Instagram videos, and I would love to shine a light on an issue that you speak so wonderfully and brilliantly about. And that is, there's two pieces to this. Number one is you talk about Quitlet.
Yes.
And how you were trying to find comps for your book, which if you guys don't know from the publishing world, you're supposed to find, I think it's like at least three comparative books that are much like yours and have done really well, and how yours will be different or better or whatever. And you couldn't find them. Can you talk about why? And let's talk about that issue.
Yeah. I mean, in 2008, when I was going through all this, again, back to being that self-sufficient person that I was, I actually kind of discreetly went to my local bookstore to see if I could find a book that talked about what I was experiencing. And obviously there were books on postpartum. I didn't see much on postpartum anxiety then. It was more about postpartum depression, which I didn't connect with. There were books on addiction. There were books on divorce. You know, all these things that I was going through, but none of them written by women who look like me. And the ones that were written by women who look like me were not written from the point of view or the intersection of privilege, which is also part of my story. You know, my story doesn't include prostitutions and drug dens and homelessness. And those seem to be like the three pieces of criteria for Black women's stories when you're talking about addiction. And so I couldn't find myself in those stories, and I could find myself in the stories written by white women, but they didn't look like me. So the culture wasn't really reflected for me. And the culture is a really big thing because there's a huge stigma in the Black community about seeking help for any mental health issue, including addiction. It is, you know, and you go back, you know, 400 years where talking about family business or personal things outside of the family might have been dangerous. It might have been endangered your life, right? Because of the segregation and the racism. So that's been carried through generationally. And now there's still a really strong stigma around not discussing these things. You know, what I'm doing right now on your podcast is extremely taboo. So the best way for me to find anything would have been in a book. And I could not find such book because it didn't exist. And then 13 years later, because this was 2020, and I'm 13 years sober and I'm looking for those comps, I'm shocked / outraged to find that none such book exists still. You know, 14 years have passed and there's still no book written by a woman, forget a Black woman, just any woman of color, who has an experience that was similar to mine. And so, yeah, I had no comparisons for my book. I had to use books written by white women. I couldn't use any book written by a woman of color because they didn't sell the way that publishers want them to have sold. And there really just weren't any. The one that was the most popular, and I'll give her a shout out, it's A Piece of Cake by Cupcake Brown. Phenomenal book. Includes those three pieces of criteria that I was talking about, drug dens, homelessness, and prostitution. But it was written in 2007. And that's it. That's it. So this space, which is this genre, is a fairly new genre. It's not new. You know, people have been writing about addiction and alcoholism for years, but they've created a new category for it called quitlit, and that's Q-U-I-T, and then L-I-T, like quit your job, and then literature. And it's a category, a genre for people who want to examine their relationship with drugs and alcohol, whether they want to just look at it or modify or stop altogether. My book falls very neatly into it. And, you know, my podcast is called The Only One in the Room. My book, Stash, My Life in Hiding, is the only one on the shelf, or the virtual shelf, as it were. And while I'm really happy that my book is out there and doing well, I just think it's such a tragedy that I'm the only one. Like, there should be a plethora. There's so many white women's books from all different, like, you know, there's diversity within this category of white women who have written these books. There's age diversity, there's location diversity, there's nationality diversity, but there's a socioeconomic diversity, but there's really no other diversity. And so for me to be the token, and I understand, you know, there needs to be a first. And then this is another reason why I'm asking not just everyone, but particularly white women to buy my book. One, I think you'll connect with it, even regardless of what you might think. And two,
absolutely,
it tells publishers, hey, we want more of these stories. It can't just be on Black women to buy my book, because it's not enough. It has to be everyone. And then they'll start seeking out these stories, which would be phenomenal.
Yeah, absolutely. On that same note, one thing that you said in the book was that you, when you were kind of debating, like, should I do something about this, say something about this, go to rehab? It may have been in the Rock Bottom chapter, I don't remember. But you talked about how you felt like if I say something and everybody, like everyone's going to know, then I take all the Black women down with me. And yes, you felt like that burden on your shoulders. I mean, I'm assuming that's why there are not more books like yours and more stories out like yours. It's certainly not because everyone doesn't struggle with addiction, or many, many people and different types of people struggle with addiction. But could you speak about like that? I had to pause and I got emotional because you already had so much fucking pressure on you.
Yeah.
Of course, that didn't cross my mind at all. But to read the weight of your fellow women,
yes,
and people who look like you and have experienced things like you on your shoulders is so heavy.
Yeah, I thank you for bringing that up. That is something I could talk about all day to anyone who would listen. I mean, the truth is that Black women are exhausted. We just are. And there is, you know, obviously there's physical exhaustion, which is a component of emotional and mental and spiritual exhaustion, mm-hmm. but the burden that we carry in this country, and I can only speak from my experience as an American, I've been Black in white spaces almost my entire life. And I've either been the only one or one of a few. And when I wrote that, that's in the chapter Black in Malibu, where I'm writing about being asked to become the new Parent Association president. There hadn't been another Black Parent Association president since 1974. So this was 2008. And she was in a very famous family, this one. So it was like, it was, I don't know. I think it was more of a fetishizing that she was named the Black. I don't know. I wasn't there then, but it felt like people were really excited because she was from this famous family. I was not from a famous family, but I had been asked to become this. And, you know, right away, one of the Black moms at my school, and I will never forget this moment. She like hems me up. As soon as she hears, she hems me up against the wall and she puts her finger in my face. And she's like, you know, you're representing us all now. Mm. And, you know, after I wanted to smack that finger out of my face, I had to, you know, just agree with her because I was. And if you think about a school with, you know, 800 students, which is, you know, around 1,600 or more family members, a lot more because then it's double. a lot of family members. And, you know, maybe, you know, like 1% of those are Black. So, you know, like I'm going to say, you know, maybe 17 or 18 students in the whole school are Black. Think about that if it were just male and female, right? So like maybe each man, if it was an all-male school and there were, you know, 15 women in the school, they would have, you know, encounters with them, right? They'd be like, oh yeah, I had that woman or that girl in my class today. But these women would carry the burden of representing women for these men, right? Because they're in school all day, every day, you know, learning, but they are the dominant culture. And the women, you know, if they're hysterical, if they are too sensitive, if they, you know, get their period, whatever it is, they're going to think that's how women are. Right? Yes. They're going to represent women for them. Kids spend most of their lives in school, right? That's what we do. Parents like me who were on campus a lot, I spent a lot of my life at that school. And so when people didn't know Black people socially outside of the school, when I was the representative for the Black people there, I did represent Black people everywhere to them. You know, if I was a junkie, then Black moms could be junkies. Did you hear? Mm. I'm so, you know, that's so tragic. The idea would be to separate from me at that point. I can't think of what the word I want to use is, but the instinct would be to connect with me if we're alike. And then the instincts also to disconnect from me if we're not alike. And I don't know if that makes sense, but that's the way it feels. It feels like when I'm good, people want me around. And when I'm not good, whatever that means, then people want to distance themselves from me.
Like and you so, can't just be a real person with struggles.
Yes, yes. Because it means this is how Black people are, or this is how Black women are.
Mm. Like even just imagining that and feeling it for a second is so lonely and heavy. I'm sorry.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. You know, when I was younger, when I was little, it was okay. Like I was, it didn't feel like I was othered. It just felt like I was different and that was okay. But it still was, it came at a cost. And I didn't realize the cost until I was older.
Yeah.
And so there's always a cost for that, which is why, you know, my message, you know, what I talk about when I'm asked to speak so often, it's about intentional inclusion and looking around at whatever space you're in and seeing who's missing. And then not only that, but like looking to see how welcome would they be in the space, you know, down, is there a ramp for someone with a disability to get into the room I'm in, to visible diversity where you're just not seeing enough color in the room, whatever that looks like. In, you know, in curriculum, in your children's curriculum, to make sure that the what they're studying is diverse. Even math can be diverse. Even word problems can be diverse. You know, and I'm not just talking about black and white here. I'm talking about true diversity, a wealth of experience, because there's so many. Mm-hmm. And it just goes unnoticed most of the time. It's been made to be normal. And I want to unnormalize it.
Mm. Yeah, that's big work. More pressure. I hope that you have a practice or something that creates lightness for you while you do all of this big work that you're doing.
I do.
Yeah.
I do. Yeah.
Lastly, I just would love for you to say whatever you would want to say to someone listening that is burying shame of any type. I don't even want to be specific, because that is a very heavy theme in your book. That to me, that's what spoke to me. I was raised in shame, just for being a girl and for having, you know, a sexuality. And that's something that I've broken free of over the last couple of years. And yeah, I just would love to know if someone's listening and they are just kind of in a place of burying that, hiding it and living with it in secret, what would you say to her?
Well, I mean, I carried my shame with me into the rooms of recovery almost 15 years ago, and I kept it very close during that first year that I was in recovery. I never told my story because I was angry, which is, I think, the flip side of that coin of shame. That anger kept people away from me. And, you know, once I told my story, what I realized was all these things that I've been so ashamed of were, one, my experience was my greatest asset because I could help other people with it.
Mm.
You know, I work out 5 days a week, and I was telling a younger friend of mine that I missed a week and I did like a low impact Peloton class, which normally it's fine. But I didn't do well in the class. At all.
Oh,
like basically I barely finished it. And I was telling her this and she says, oh my God, thank you so much for telling me this, because I picture you, you know, at the top of the leaderboard every day because you work out every day and you look the way you do and blah, blah, blah. She goes, that gives me so much comfort to know that you failed out of a low impact class. I could barely make it through. And this was something that I would have kept to myself, you know, 15 years ago, because I wouldn't want to have burst that bubble that she had, not knowing how connecting that is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she connected with me in a way that she couldn't connect with me if I were up on this pedestal, if I were in that glass box. There is no connection. That's just her admiring me. And like I said, I like the admiration. It feels good. But what I craved was the connection, and I didn't even know it. And so it's not that I need to overshare all the time, but that stuff that is that sticky, toxic stuff that I'm afraid to let anybody see, there are people in my life with whom I share that stuff regularly now. And then sometimes I do share it at a recovery meeting. I shared it in Stash My Life in Hiding. I share it, you know, I'm sharing it in this interview. Like I share this stuff now. And the result is that I'm more connected than ever. And my access to freedom and joy is, I mean, it's so improved isn't the right word, but it was so out of reach before. Freedom was something that I didn't even know. Like I knew the word, obviously, I understand the word, but I hadn't lived in it before. Mm. And I'm really truly living in freedom, which allows me to experience joy in a real way. Like there are things that I love that I literally jump up and down about, And they're not, you know, like material things. It's, well, my bed. I jump up and down about my bed. I love my bed.
A good mattress. Yes. After my divorce, I got a new mattress and I invested in that shit. And every night I'm just like starfishing by myself in the bed. Like, I love my bed and my room.
I love it. I'm the same. And it does bring me joy. Writing brings me joy. You know, my kids, we have a family dinner every Sunday and it's chaotic and nobody got what they want. And, you know, it's like talking over each other and, but we're all together and I'm in heaven. Mm. I'm in absolute heaven. So that's what I get to experience as a result of taking, you know, the pressure or the cap off the pressure cooker of shame and letting that steam out.
Yeah. Free yourself. You're keeping yourself captive.
Yes.
Beautiful. Oh my gosh, my friend. I am so glad to meet you and so happy to be able to talk with you today. Every single person listening, go on Amazon. I think you can get it on Target, at Barnes & Noble. Go somewhere. Go to your indie bookstore, wherever you want. Go get this book. Get a copy for a friend. It is such a good, easy read. We're heading into summer. This is a great book to just read on the beach while your kids play. Like, show up, get this book, support this woman, support. We support women here. So go get the book. And follow Laura on Instagram. You're just like a powerful presence. I really like what you have on your Instagram. So thank you for just being you.
I appreciate that. And I appreciate the support so much. And I appreciate your show and you inviting me on. This has been so much fun. Thank you.
Of course. Thank you.
Friend, thank you so much for hanging out with me and letting me be a part of your day. It means so much to me. If you would like more like behind the scenes view into my life, this lifestyle, regular like life hacks, tips, and more content that's really gonna create lightness in your social media feed, follow me on Instagram at Ali_that's me, or you can search Ali Casaza and it's the one with the blue check mark. If this episode or any episodes was helpful for you, please consider leaving me a review on Apple Podcasts. It is literally the lifeblood for a podcaster and it helps me so much. Thank you for tuning in. If you would like to learn more from me, how I can help you, how you can implement the things we talk about here on The Purpose Show, leaning more into making life simpler, better, and more abundant in the best ways, head to alicasaza.com. There are free downloads, online programs, and other resources to help you create the life you really want in a very deep dive style. I am always rooting for you, friend. I will see you next time. I'm Ali Casaza, and this is The Purpose Show.